Today is May 17th. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original Personal Computer Radio Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. We are heard each Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM on the Internet at 6 p.m. Eastern Time and on WBAI-FM 99.5 on the radio at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Our website is pcradioshow.org. The Personal Computer Show on WBAI-FM has been preempted this evening for a membership drive. We will not be on tonight at 9 p.m. However, even when we are preempted on WBAI for fundraising, we continue to do a regular broadcast each week on PRN.FM. Our broadcasts are available for downloading from PRN.FM, WBAI.org, and our website, pcradioshow.org. The WBAI archive may list us as the program of record with the replacement program. However, the program may not necessarily reflect our views. More specifically, we do not endorse the premiums or the views pitched by last week's replacement program.
Hi there, Joe. I got you on remote. Are you there?
I am here, Hank. I'm hanging by a thread. I can't wait for you to tell me what was last week's premium.
Well, we didn't have a premium because this is PRN.FM. Hey, Joe, I got to tell everyone that this is a beautiful day in New York, and you're sitting on your sofa sipping Novocaine while the heat is up to, what, 90 degrees in New York?
Well, the heat here was only 88, and the Novocaine is slowly wearing off. It's been, just about 2.5 hours now, and I hope it's gone in time for me to have dinner.
Well, because when you first spoke to me about 2.5 hours ago, you were mumbling, and I didn't know what the heck you were saying.
I could understand myself perfectly.
But, you know, in the past week, the big news, of course, is the cyber hacking with ransomware, and there's a lot of confusion on that because I've heard terms like WannaCry, WannaCrypt, WannaCryptor. It's all the same thing, except it's being referred to by many different names. And I think even the government website is referring it to with a whole lot of different names, but it's the same piece of malware. And the way it's, let's talk about how it's introduced, okay? It comes in by social engineering. In other words,
No, I don't agree with you. I don't call that social engineering. I call that inviting stupid people to infect their machine.
Oh, now, come on now. What they say is attach is something that I want you to look at. And if you don't know who is sending it to you, and a lot of people don't because some of the things are very enticing, attaches a certificate for 50% off or something like that, and you click on it.
Yes, it is. And let me tell you, those same people have been responding to my urgent plea that I want to give them at no charge a free bridge so that they can charge money on the Brooklyn Bridge. And it's amazing how many people accept the offer.
Well,
Hank, we have said on the air for the last umpteen years, unless you know what is at the end of that link, never click on a link, even if it's from a friend, from your mother, from your priest. Don't click on a link unless you know for a fact what's at the end of that link. We get mail all the time saying things like, dear computer folk, can you answer this problem that I've attached a picture? You know, I've never once found out what those pictures were. I'm not enticed.
Well,
if you get a piece of email and it does not contain the information you need to function based on that email, then it's obviously a piece of malware. Throw it away. And if the next day you get a letter, for example, from Hank saying, why didn't you open up my mail, curse him out for sending a blind link.
Well, one of the things I do want to talk about this evening is that I just want to know if in the education system they go through that, I don't know if it's Aesop or some fable about Henny Penny saying the sky is falling, the sky is falling. And that is what the mainstream media seems to be doing when they're talking about, you know, these machines being impacted and so on. And unless...
Can you tell us actually who is being impacted, Hank? Do you know?
Yes, I can tell you because, you know, when they say, you know, your PC is vulnerable and so on, first of all, let's give it a little background, okay? What happened was that Microsoft, in the year 2014, stopped providing patches, any kind of patches, including security patches, on XP machines, but they were patching all other systems. Actually, there were two operating systems they stopped supporting. One was Windows XP, and the other one was Windows 8. That's it, Windows 8. And last year... Oh, I don't know what sometime.
Wait a minute. Wait, before you, Hank, let me clarify something. I don't have 8, but I do have 8.1. Is that a difference from Microsoft's point of view?
Yes. And if you were to upgrade 8 to 8.1, you're covered, okay? However, there are no patches for XP until it was announced 2 days ago that Microsoft will and has been providing patches for Windows XP to take care of this vulnerability. And if you're running XP and you are connected, I got to be careful of that, and you're connected to a public network, in other words, you go out to the internet, then make sure you get that patch. But, I see numbers like, 1.3 billion PCs are out there, everyone's in trouble. Let's look at the numbers carefully, okay? The 1.3 billion PCs is what the network monitoring system can sense because it's connected to the network. But there are many older machines not connected to the public network, such as vertical applications like ATM machines, the monitoring machines at a lot of hospitals. In fact, many of the hospitals, because I've been in and out of the hospital in the past year, and their machines are not connected to a public network. And they are running XP for two reasons. The application... Go ahead, Joe.
You're talking the vertical applications of these hospitals, not their communication machines.
Well, they communicate in an internal where they will do monitoring, and the monitoring is on a communication, but it's internal. It does not go outside of the hospital network itself. Okay.
So if my doctor sends me an email with my test results... that machine that he sent it to me on is not connected to his other machine,
right,
which has the data that the hospital needs.
Yeah. So when you look at the real numbers, okay, of that 1.3 billion, 49% are now on Windows 7, 27% are now on Windows 10, and the third largest operating system active on a public network is still XP, over 7%. That's a lot.
7% of, what is it, over 2 billion, all the machines combined?
1.3 billion.
1.3 billion. What's 7% of that? You're a mathematician.
It comes out to about 200,000. Was it? I'm sorry. 7%. If you took 10% of that, it would be... let me put it this way. We're talking about somewhere between 100 to 150 million.
Okay. 100 to 150 million with an M.
Right, with an M.
I'll tell you, that's more machines than I got here in the office.
Now, it's been reported, okay, that there are few cases where Windows 7 was affected. However, when you dig deep into the article, you'll find in small notations, they were counterfeit Windows 7. In other words, by the way, China got hit hard because much of the Windows operating system in China are counterfeits. And if it's not installed properly, updates don't go on to it. So, you know, they run at their risk. And when you play with counterfeits, that's what happens. However, I just want to let everyone know that if you're not running, let's put it this way, if you're running Windows 7, 10, or 8.1, don't sweat it at all, okay? Although, you know, you listen to the mainstream media, they got you, you know, very worried. Now, if you're running XP and you are accessing the public network, in other words, the Internet, make sure you get those patches in.
Hank, I hate to ask you this. I know you're not going to want to answer it, but I want to ask anyway. Suppose a friend of mine is running 7, but it's not exactly legal, so he never did update it.
Let's say he or she, because you have female friends too, right?
I specifically said he as a generic because I don't want to identify her.
You are subject to a hack if you have not done the update.
And there's nothing one can do about that other than go out and get a different operating system on that machine.
Or, to paraphrase what you said, make sure you got an activated counterfeit. We'll leave it at that, okay? So, most people don't realize that with a counterfeit. I'll just say this in a very circumscribed way, okay? There are counterfeits and there are counterfeits. I guess that's why my saying there are counterfeits that you cannot distinguish any difference between a real and a counterfeit. And their counterfeits are so poorly put together that you wonder where the heck they got it from. And we'll leave it at that, okay?
But in your knowledge today, what's the cheapest version of Windows cost? Well, how much could I get Windows for if I wanted to go out and buy a new copy?
Actually, you can still buy Windows 7 today, and depending on what version you want. In other words, you have the Home Premium and you got the Pro, but they range anywhere from $80 to $100 for a full install, and the upgrades, they're a lot less, but they range all over the lot, okay?
But so you're saying for around $80 to $100, somebody could get a clean, honest operating system and not have to worry about some of the other things.
No.
Depending on what you use a computer for, it might be worthwhile. It might be a good investment.
Wait. I got to put out a caveat there, okay? You have to make sure that it is a legitimate distribution disk and not an OEM disk, okay? What I mean by OEM disk is that some of the people were selling OEM disk and it came from Dell or Lenovo or HP, and it's specific to the OEM and not to the general installation itself from
right.
Microsoft.
You're not going to find one of those disks out in your neighborhood Staples store, but you are liable to find one like that on one of the auction sites.
Not only auction sites like eBay, but also these clone makers, okay? In other words, the white box people, they say, hey, I'll put a machine together for you. And that's where the biggest trouble is.
If you get a white box, like Hank just said, just make sure that it runs before you take it home.
Now, once you have that Windows 7, you can, and let's say it's legitimate, okay? Then you can upgrade to Windows 10 immediately. And I would recommend that you do that. This way you're not...
Incidentally, Hank... I upgraded a Acer, I think it was a netbook, and you know the number of it. Was a D250 or
No. What you did was you updated a D150, which is one of the original netbooks from Acer.
And it's a legitimate update, except it runs very slowly.
Well,
may not want to put 10 on your machine.
Okay. I think you're exaggerating it, though. But, you know, people would say to me, how fast is Windows 10 compared to Windows 7? Well, let's assume that all things were equal. 7 was equal to 10 in speed. But the problem is that the big difference between Windows 7 and Windows 10 was that they compacted the size of Windows 10 by taking a lot of the kernel modules and compressing it so that each time those modules are needed, when it gets loaded, they have to expand the modules to run it. So therefore, that is what makes it slow, because when you bring in the operating modules that have been compressed, you got to go through that expansion before you can actually access it. So therefore, just by virtue of design, it will run slower. Now, obviously, if you can put more memory in, well, you're going to pick up speed. But a netbook was limited to two gig memory, and that was it. You couldn't put any more on. But you know what, Joe? It's time to, you know what? It's time to help the economy. Go buy a new machine.
I've bought a couple since then. But that was one that I kept sitting next to the TV in the living room just as a convenience. In case I saw something on TV and I wanted to look it up or run something or buy something.
You know, Joe, can I tell you the amazing thing about that Acer D150? Because I have one. I know a number of other people that they have it. That machine came out in 2007, and it's still, in a sense, very useful for what you use it for. It's amazing. Well, it's 10 years old.
I've run XP on it. I've won 7 on it. I never ran 8 on it, and I got 10 on it. And I was most happy with the way it ran under 7, but XP was much, much faster.
Yeah, but you know what? For the for many of the newbies, in other words, people buying a PC for the first time, 7 was more power-oriented, whereas 10 is more like sort of like a more on automatic cruise control, okay? Unfortunately, the automatic cruise control was sometimes you had no control over it, and Microsoft would say, I'm updating you whether you like it or not. I'm pushing
That's
things
correct.
Down to you.
Do you remember what you paid for?
Which one, the Acer?
The D150. The D150.
Oh, it was, I remember it was about $275. It was $250 with the shipping and so on. It came out to about $275.
No, actually, it started off at $235 and was another $35 for shipping. For me, I don't know. You bought it.
So now, wait a minute. $235 plus $30 for shipping came out to $265. I said $270. You're going to take me on the $5, $10 difference?
Absolutely. I don't get to do that too often with you.
Well, for Black Friday last November.
There you beat us all.
Yeah, well, I got it for $100, a Windows 10 machine, and Dell was pretty sneaky about it. They said that we have the special for $100, limited quantities, and we don't take orders until 6 p.m. Eastern Time on Thanksgiving Day. And it's sort of like in my home, my son was there and my wife is saying, hey, it's time for dinner. No, not yet. And we were trying to get more than one machine, but I'm glad I got one. And they had it in 3 colors, okay? And
Which did you get?
Well, I wanted the red one because they had 3 colors, but it turns out that they said, we only have the white left. I said, okay, I'll take the white. The 3 colors was red, white, and blue.
Well, the white was the most popular one in the whole series. And I don't really know why. Maybe people thought it looked more like an apple. But I trust that you bought it just to give to your granddaughter or one of your granddaughters. Well, you have a problem there. You've got several granddaughters.
Ah, Joe.
Do it with one machine.
Joe, I got more than one machine.
Ah, good for you.
Hey, Joe, let me just switch a little bit. I hope that we've covered this area that number one is that this vulnerability. Oh, I do want to say one thing about this vulnerability is that Microsoft is not very happy at all because NSA has been compiling these vulnerabilities with their studies. And you would
think
that...
You're using alphabet soup again. What is NSA?
The National Security Agency.
Oh, you mean our government? The U.S. and a government?
Yeah, and instead of telling the publishers about the vulnerabilities, they stockpile them, and they got hacked, and they're saying, why didn't you tell
us? Hold it. You're saying that the NSA, the National Security Agency, our government's answer to hackerdom all over the world, got hacked?
Yep.
Oh, bother.
Hey, listen.
Now, next thing you're going to do is tell me the Easter Bunny doesn't have ears.
Well, let me put it this way. I don't trust the government on anything, all right? And that's why, we differ on politics. So
that's silly. If you don't trust the government on anything, then I strongly urge you get your passport in order and leave.
But it has to be issued by the government, okay?
Well, you got a catch 22 there.
Yeah. Hey, you know, we got something in the mailbag, and let me just go over it. A very simple sentence. The person says, his question was, can files be recovered from an external drive which is corrupted and unreadable? If so, what's the procedure? And the computer is a PC. Now, I make the assumption that he has a PC, and he has an external drive, which is probably powered in its own box, connected to it, and somehow he can't read it. And I do have an answer for it. Yes?
Hank, why do you think it's a separate box that's... why couldn't it just be a USB drive?
It doesn't matter. He says it's connected to the PC. The computer's a PC. And he's got an external drive, which is corrupted and unreadable. So that's
so. What do you do?
Okay, well, there are two utilities that I do recommend. One is called TestDisk, TestDisk. I think the latest version is 3.0, 3.1, or something like that right now. And the utility consists of two programs. One is called TestDisk, and what this TestDisk does is that it can recover deleted files. It can try to read what it can from a corrupted file. It can identify and recover files which are also just good, and create write it onto another device so that you have it. And Joe, you remember that you had given me a USB flash drive, and what I did was I used this program, TestDisk, and of course.
I want to warn everybody, it recovered all the files, but you know what it did not recover?
Because the directory.
The file names.
Because the directory was corrupted, but at least you got the files, file one, file two, file three.
Folks, I want to tell you what Hank did for me. He gave me back my USB drive, and he gave me, a carbon copy of it, and it had 4,000 drives, 4,000 files, numbered serially from 1 through 4,000 with not a clue of what each one was.
No, wait a minute. The clue was you opened the file. Or the clue was you opened the file.
It took me almost 3 months to reorganize that and recover all of those files. And as it is, there were probably close to 1,000 files I just gave up on.
But, Joe, the alternative was you had nothing. Think about that. The alternative was I had nothing.
Yeah, it would have been a problem, but it would have taken me much less time.
Now, the other program in this test disk is called PhotoREC, PhotoREC, and what that utility does or program does within this utility is that it's very good because I recommend it highly. Very often, people don't realize that when they have a digital camera, they have an SD or micro SD chip in there, and they take pictures. And then all of a sudden, the disk itself becomes unreadable. And you say, wait a minute, I got all my pictures there. What do I do? Well, because of you might have had a hit on that disk where you lost one bit. Now, the way computers work, if you lose one bit, it's unreadable. But what PhotoREC does is says, who cares? You lost a bit, I'll fill it in. And when you think about it, if you have a picture that's like, say, 5 megapixels, 5 million pixels, and you lost one bit, you're not going to worry about it. So you have a little white dot in the picture, you'll probably fix it up, okay? So that's an excellent program. Another one that's easy, quick to use is called Recuva, R-E-C-U-V-A. Just do a search on it.
Hank, before you get on to Recuva, I just did a search, and I found that there are a number of test disc programs out there.
You want the test disc that has photo rec along with it.
Right. I'm looking at a thing called Test Disc 7.0 for Windows, and it does not have the photo rec with it.
Well, actually, if you look for photo rec, then you'll get the test disc with it. Okay? In other words, do it the other way around. In other words, go for the tail and wag the dog, okay? Instead of trying to find
Although
the dog with a tail.
They both seem to be able to fix fat tables and recovery fat 30. But, you know, we haven't tested them all, so it's just the one that has photo rec that Hank is recommending.
Yeah, so I happen to like these two utilities because if it's a bad record, it will recover as much as it can. If it's a good record, of course, it'll give it to you with the name of the proper file. If it's a photograph or even a video that you lost a part of it, hey, you know what? I think at least with video and digital pictures, losing part of a picture is, you know, it's not the end of the earth. At least you still have a part of a picture that you can get at.
What does it look like when you recover it, Hank? Maybe a white spot on it or a dot or two.
White. When I say a dot, it's a white dot, okay? And very often you just go over and just fill it in with the proper color that, you know, matches. Hey,
right.
By the way, I just wanted to let people know that the second half of the show is coming up and that we have four segments that we're featuring. And Alfred Poor, he's got a wonderful one that I was very interested in about the artificial limbs that are being fitted into, we're talking about wearable tech in terms of medicine. It's very interesting. I raised a question with lithium batteries. You know, what's going to happen when you have all these electric cars? We're going to have a huge stockpile of stuff in the that's non-recyclable. I found out, much to my surprise, they are recyclable. And Joe Rejeski has a great tip, another good one. And Marty Winston has also has been coming through with home automation. Boy, he's got some other stuff in there. I really want to put him on, but you know what? We just
Hank,
so much.
Hank, before we get over to that segment, I'd like to remind the folks who are listening that they can contact you by writing to pcradio@gmail.com.
Yeah,
By
the way, I just want to tell everyone that if you have friends that you want to say, hey, we got to, I heard about this on the PC radio show, the personal computer show, they could get it from prn.fm. If you go to prn.fm, not only you can get the current program that's going on, but you can also retrieve the information and the instructions are there. And you could go to pcradioshow.org. We go back a little further than that. And you can go to wbai.org and I don't know. Listen, they're still fundraising. They fundraise more than they have regular shows, and I'm happy that we're here and we're able to continue to give everyone the kind of information that they're looking for. And I do want to repeat what I said earlier. Last week's premium and views, we don't share those, okay? I just want to say that.
Hank, I want to specify last week's premium on WBAI-FM, not anything that PRN.FM is clean right through everything.
Yes. So let's get on to the second half of the show.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearable technology from Health Tech Insider. I'd like you to take a moment and look at an object that you have nearby and just reach out and pick it up. Okay, now let's think about what just happened. You probably didn't think about guiding your hand to the object and then individually controlling your fingers to reach out and grab it with a certain amount of pressure and then move your hand and wrist and forearm in a certain motion to complete the process of picking up the item. What you probably did was just reached out and picked it up. Now, it's a simple task for somebody with their natural arm and hand, but for somebody wearing a prosthetic arm and hand, it's a much more difficult process, especially if the hand is powered and is linked to your nerves and your muscles. It's very difficult for a lot of users to adapt to this and get beyond the point where they have to think about each individual motion. And as a result, the process of picking something up or using that prosthetic hand becomes much more complicated and tedious and slow and unsatisfying. There's a possible solution to all this. The answer is a hand that can see. Researchers at Newcastle University have developed a prosthetic hand that actually has a camera built into the back of it so that it can see what the hand sees and what it's approaching. It actually relies on artificial intelligence, a system of software that's built on neural networks, and it learns to identify the object you're reaching for. Once it knows what it's looking to pick up, it will automatically trigger a whole set of procedures that are already in place to make the appropriate movements, to control the fingers, to control the wrist motion, and so forth, so that it can reach out and pick up the object without you having to think about it. This is a major advancement. Could make the prosthetic arms much more responsive, much easier for users to work with during the day doing normal tasks, and provide a much more satisfactory experience for them. Smart hands could be the future for prosthetic devices. Diseases and conditions such as macular degeneration rob thousands of people of their eyesight every year. Basically, it's a problem wherein the nerve cells that perceive the light coming into your eye, where they die or are damaged or whatever, and no longer can transmit that light into a signal that can be interpreted by the optic nerve. We've written a lot about attempts to create artificial retinas to address this kind of a problem. People who are developing tiny silicon chips that have a matrix of photosensors on them that create electrical signals. Recently, we've covered a plastic film that has chemicals on it that can convert the light into electrical impulses that can directly stimulate the nerves without the need for electrical contacts or a matrix of electrodes. But now there's research coming out of Oxford University where a doctoral student has come up with a rather novel approach to the whole problem. The problem with the chips and electrodes and things like that is they can be very damaging to the eye, which is, as you might imagine, is very sensitive to injury. The plastic film idea is a good one because it can be less traumatic for the eye. But this researcher at Oxford University has come up with a way to use what's called a hydrogel, which is a very soft material, very flexible. As its name suggests, it's made mostly out of water. This doctoral candidate has discovered a way to embed chemicals in there, in this hydrogel, that are photosensitive and can actually generate an electrical current in response to light exposure. Again, there's no need for electrodes. The chemical in that location where the light hits will create an electrical current that, at least in theory, can stimulate the nerves in the back of the eye. This would be a very soft synthetic material that could be easily conformed to the back of the eyeball, minimal impact on the eye itself. It's very early days for this approach. They're still experimenting with it and testing to see what its properties are and how to improve them. They're still some ways off from animal trials, which would be the next step, but eventually it could lead to clinical trials for humans and could help people who've lost their vision to see again. No doubt you know about origami, the art form that started in Asia, which involves folding paper, but you may be less familiar with the art of paper cutting. Again, in Asia, it's a refined art form, and the artists can create amazing works of art using it. A group of scientists working together in China and the U.S. have actually used the concept of the paper cutting art to create a lightweight, flexible device that actually generates power from motion. It looks kind of like a paper waffle, and basically it's just a paper matrix that's been coated with graphite, which is a form of carbon, very common and inexpensive, a little bit of gold, and a thin plastic film. As this grid is compressed and released, it actually generates electricity. you could have a small device like this in your pocket, in your wallet, in your shoes, someplace, and it could actually generate electricity. The concept is that by harvesting the energy of your normal motions, it could generate enough electricity to power wearable devices, a smartwatch, provide extra power for your smartphone or whatever. This simple, inexpensive paper device could harvest enough energy to be useful and extend the life of your mobile electronics. For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. Inquiring minds asked, what to do with all the lithium batteries that cannot be recycled and are not biodegradable? Well, I got news for you. Lithium batteries are able to be recycled, and this is accomplished via their closed-loop battery recycling program with this group in the United States, Kinsbersky Brothers, and this group in Europe, Umicore, and Tesla will soon form a partnership with an Asian recycling company as well. A closed group of material use involves manufacturing of battery cells, assembly into battery packs, then vehicles, and finally recycling into raw materials for future use. At Tesla, they have been refining their recycling program for years before sending out battery packs to be recycled, and they can reuse about 10% of the battery pack by weight, for example, the battery case and some electronic components. Here is an explanation of Umicore's recycling process for Tesla batteries. The Umicore battery's recycling technology is able to save at least 70% on CO2 emission at the recovery and refining of these valuable metals. It does this by creating products and byproducts rather than following a mechanical separation process. Product is comprised of an alloy that's refined into cobalt, nickel, and other metals. Traditionally, cobalt is used as a metallic powder to harden tools or pigment for ceramics. Umicore has developed a process whereby the cobalt is used to make up LCO, which stands for lithium cobalt oxide, that can be resold to battery manufacturers. The byproduct produced together with the alloy fraction is an environment-friendly slag where the lithium contained in EV batteries ends up. It contains lithium, which is valorized in different applications, one being construction material. Nearly 5% of the global man-made CO2 emissions worldwide are produced by cement manufacturing. Replacing the raw material with secondary raw material and avoiding thermal processing significantly reduces CO2 emission and non-renewable resources consumption. With a byproduct, the construction industry is able to use this secondary raw material as a more environmental conscious alternative. The only other emissions from the recycling process are CO2, water vapor, and dust. The dust makes up about 1% of the total output and goes to protected landfills. In an effort to reuse every possible part of the process, the Umicore facility even sells electricity created from an on-site combined natural gas generation plant to the copper mine next door, which uses the heat in its smelters. So, lithium battery packs not only save thousands of gallons of gasoline, diesel over the life of the vehicle, it's also less toxic than lead-acid batteries that are in regular cars. Then, at this moment, much of it is being recycled with the ultimate goal of 100% reusability of the batteries. Not much guilt to be had in this sweet, sweet ride other than the price tag, of course. And we all expect it to be happening hopefully soon. Well, with that explanation, you're just about as confused as I am.
You know, every time we think we're done developing the electronics or the plans for electronics for our 40-year house project, that's at 40yearhouse.com, numbers or spell it out, 40yearhouse.com. Every time we think it's ready to lock it down and make it work, some new technology comes along that kind of makes sense, kind of want to fit it in. So there's a lot of testing and prototyping involved with this project. It feels like the 70s again, soldering irons and breadboards and all that stuff. But the thing I want to talk about today is microwaves. Not in ovens and not in communications directly, but microwaves as deployed in various kinds of radar. If you had an alarm system, or your parents did, or your kids did in the 80s, a lot of them advertised that they were radar alarms, and that was, in fact, a microwave field disturbance radar. Anything that moved in there, which meant it was mostly Doppler, anything that moved in there would make a signal come back, and the radar triggered. That sometimes included the blowing of a heater, and sometimes included cats and dogs going across the room. It was notorious for a lot of false positives. Other radars work in different ways. For example, the original radar beam was a simple echolocation kind of device. Imagine you have somebody who can throw a baseball at a constant speed, and you pair that with somebody who can throw a baseball at exactly the same speed. The first guy throws to the second guy throws it back to the first guy, and you know from the amount of time that took how long a distance it covered. That's how early radar worked. It would send out a ping, it would bounce off an object, the echo of that microwave signal would come back, and a rotating display would indicate by the position of that blip along a line, which was actually the displacement of a centered dot by the electrical signal, how far away they were. So that's why they look like what they look like. That time of flight technology is used in ultrasonics. It's used in LIDAR. In radar, it's really good at measuring distance. And if you have data on distance measurement, you can derive speed. But there is a type of radar that was built specifically for speed, and that is Doppler radar, the thing that you see on the weather every night. Doppler is that shift as trains go by, or as they approach you, same kind of thing. If the frequency shifts and you measure that change in frequency, you know the speed. It's because speeds and the effect on the audio wave or the microwave or the light pulse speed, I mean, there are no Doppler light pulses I know of, but that would be interesting, that speed is causing an elongation or a narrowing of the wavelength, which is the inverse of the frequency. And so the tone switches. Radars in a home that can measure distance are kind of okay if you're dealing with approach stuff. Radars that measure speed are kind of okay. We'll get back to the Doppler in a minute and those old alarm systems. Now, we're seeing prototypes out there, very, very encouraging prototypes, and some experiments that mean a small radar head, about the size of a smaller tablet or a larger smartphone. Those small heads can fit on a ceiling or under a mattress. The clothing and the mattress itself are pretty much invisible to them. And they can report a lot more data than the few things we're looking for. I'd like to know if there's somebody there or not, and whether by measuring their heart rate, they're awake or asleep. Should be fairly clear. So I took a look at these experiments and did some correspondence with some of the guys behind it and some of the new products that are coming out very soon now. Prices on the experimental side start with modules that are about $10. The commercial stuff, probably $250 to $350 each. You don't need a lot of them in a house. These things, the output waveform of these things are just incredible. You can easily discern heart rate. You can also tell if people are fidgety or not. In other hands, because I'm not going to pretend to have any medical training, in other hands, they should be extraordinarily good at determining the quality of sleep. It might also be a brilliant way to monitor geriatric patients who would tear off the wearables that they're usually given for that kind of monitoring. And if there are special needs elsewhere, This is easy. It's adaptive. It's not crazy. So where does that lead us for a 40-year house? What I have in mind is specifically what I said, monitoring the beds, each sleeping position independently, and if possible, then it may not be, monitoring the living room sofa in each of its positions or the easy chair. Really don't want to do that so much, but if somebody's in the living room watching TV and falls asleep, do you leave the TV on? Do you turn the TV off? What do you do with the lights? In the bedroom, it's the same kind of decision. If you're sitting in bed and reading, you're fairly motionless, but you're very likely sitting up. If you're sitting in bed watching TV, you may be sitting up, but you might also be in exactly the same position you would be asleep. If you fall asleep while watching TV in bed at night when it's dark, which our sensors can easily tell, then isn't it a courtesy to turn off the TV, to dim the room lights? If we know whether the person in the other bed position is already in bed, then we treat it as a nighty-night. If that other person is not already in bed, then we dim the lighting to a point where it doesn't bother a sleeper, but it keeps the other partner from bumping into stuff on the way to bed. Consider four walls. Deciding whether the wall behind you, the wall ahead of you, the wall to your left, or the wall to your right should be bright or dim or on or off or any of those things really sensitively responds to what you're doing at the time. If you sit on the bed to tie your shoes, it's easy to tell that. If you're sitting in bed to read, it's easy to tell that. If you're in bed sitting and watching TV, monitor the current to the TV, and it's easy to tell that. If you're lying down in bed watching TV, it's a lot more difficult, and I don't believe that a smart house should make any of its occupants wear anything to tell. These are radars, and that radar that's doing those heartbeat and fidgeting moves are, by and large, Doppler radars, by and large, taking advantage of tiny motion, the things that used to trigger the false alarms in those home security systems. I might also add, simple presence detection, which is what those home security systems did, might also have a role, but I don't believe a primary role in things like detecting if somebody's at the door, detecting if somebody's in the driveway. The reason is they are so prone to false alarms, but every technology is somewhat. So they're very good as a way to confirm and corroborate that what the other sensor detected is more likely really seeing something. You don't want a nervous Nelly house that alerts you because the wind is blowing. What you might want is a nervous Nelly house that tells you you're about to miss our next episode. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Marty.
When you're sitting at your computer, do you pick up your mobile phone to send or view text messages? Why not use your computer instead? Do you do this? You're answering emails on your computer when a text message is delivered to your mobile phone. You pick up your phone and respond, and then back to your computer. A little later, another text message arrives. Pick up your phone, respond, back to your computer. Why pick up your phone a dozen or more times a day? Many wireless providers offer an app or a website that allows you to send and receive text messages from your computer. For example, Verizon has a website for text messaging. It's web.vma.vzw.com, as well as an app, Message Plus, that you can install on your computer. If you send more than a few text messages a day, it's probably a good idea to have that app or website open all day on your computer while you work. Just call your mobile phone provider and ask what they offer for sending and receiving text messages from your computer instead of your mobile phone. Don't know their phone number? Just Google customer service followed by your mobile phone provider. Now, if your wireless provider does not offer an application or website for sending and receiving text messages, there are other companies that offer this service. But be careful, my friend, if you're giving access to your private information to a company that is not your carrier. If you just want to send a quick text message using email, such as Outlook, Gmail, etc., Just address your email to the person's phone number, no dashes, followed by one of the domains that their phone number belongs to. Here are a few domains for popular carriers you can reference for sending text messages from your email account. For Verizon, it's phone number at vtext.com, and for phone number, you're going to substitute the recipient's phone number. For AT&T, it's phone number at txt.att.net. For Sprint, it's phone number at messaging.sprintpcs.com. And for T-Mobile, it's phone number at tmomail.net. You need to know the carrier to which the phone number belongs. For example, you can't use vtext.com to send a message to someone whose phone number is with AT&T. To find out which carrier phone number belongs to, just go to www.carrierlookup.com and enter the recipient's phone number. Here's an example. To send a text message to a Verizon customer with the phone number 123-456-7890, just address an email to 123-456-7890@vtext.com. If the person is an AT&T customer and you sent the email to 123-456-7890@vtext.com, the message would not be delivered. You would need to email 123-456-7890 at txt.att.net instead. Now, if you save this information as a secondary email address for your contacts in Outlook or Gmail, you can easily recall this address when you need to send a text message using email. Remember, text messages need to be less than 160 characters, so keep that in mind when using email to send a text message. There you go. That's this week's Simple Computer Tips for Busy People. Try this tip now, and you'll never forget it. Did you like this tip, or do you have a computer tip for me? Let me know. Just visit www.simplecomputertipsforbusypeople.com. I'm Joe Rejeski. Over and out.
Thank you, Joe. Public service announcements. The Princeton PC Users Group will be meeting Tuesday, May 23rd, 7 p.m. in the community room at the Princeton Public Library, Princeton, New Jersey. Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on iPad and smartphone, Together at Last. Thursday, May 25th, meeting time is 6:45 p.m., meeting will be held at Middletown Library Lodge Community Room in Middletown, New Jersey. The Westchester PCs Users Group will be meeting on Thursday, June 1st, 7 p.m. at the Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road, room number 101 in White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have their general meeting on Friday, June the 2nd, starting time is 8 p.m. They will meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad located on 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The Danbury Area Computer Society will have a presentation on video and still camera technology on Tuesday, June the 6th. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m. Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. The Rockland PC Users Group will be meeting on Tuesday, June the 13th. Meeting time starts at 7:15 p.m. They meet at the Rasser Room of the Palisades Mall on the fourth floor, located at West Nyack, New York. The Computer Learning Center at Ewing will have a presentation on smartphone ride services. Thursday, June 15th, 2 p.m., meeting at the Community Room, 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. All these meetings are open to the public. They hope that you're going to be able to make some of them. The website for the Personal Computer Radio Show is pcradioshow.org, and we communicate via Twitter at pcradio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, on the Internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio, or WBAI.org, streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.